You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 27th of November on Monocle 24. Ahead on the programme, we find out what booksellers in Hamburg, Toronto and London are saying and selling. We listen to a Brazilian music mashup as crafted by London-based DJ João Brasil. And Gert Jonkers, editor of Fantastic Man, is this week's guest magazine reviewer. The Review, in association with J. Crew.
Hello and welcome to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and Gillian Tobias.
Ahead in the next hour, we hear about music from Brazil as we host Brazilian DJ João Brasil in studio.
And once again this week, we'll be touring bookshops around the world. This weekend, we travel to Hamburg, Toronto, and we also stay in London.
There are something like 60,000 German books coming every year, and we are looking forward to the next 60,000 of next year.
That was John Cohen from the bookshop Cohen and Dobenick in Hamburg.
And joining us around our studio table for our weekly magazine review will be Gert Jonkers, editor of Fantastic Man.
All that and much more right here on The Review on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House with Tyler Brulé and Gillian Tobias.
Good morning, Tyler.
How are you?
I'm all right. More to the point, how are you?
I'm feeling it this morning. We found the new secret passage to Japan in St. John's Wood. It was a very late birthday evening last night, and I'm suffering for it.
Always good to have a new Japanese discovery for you, Tyler.
Absolutely.
I know.
One of these places, though, which I think is definitely a hangover, much like I have, I think from sort of the golden era of the Japanese banks and all of the investors and you know, all of the multinationals. Nationals being here, quite a remarkable place and quite a crowd out as well, which was good.
Unusual for St. John's Wood to have a little nightclub scene, but glad you found it.
Exactly. Should we just have a quick whiz through the papers? What have you got over there?
Well, I was just saying, I saw, having worked in fashion, I'm always keen to see what the British Fashion Awards and the British fashion industry is doing. Sarah Moer writes, because the fashion awards happen on Monday, so she's looking at the nominees and highlighting the kind of female talent rising to the surface in what's, you know, conventionally a male world. Phoebe Philo, Stella McCartney, and they're going to be on Monday, so we're going to sort of have a look and see who kind of percolates through.
And that's in what paper today?
That's the Times.
The Times. Do you think that awards are still relevant? You know, when you've got this, you know, proliferation of also so many, you know, big name designers, you know, going to the high street, working with, you know, the likes of H&M's and Uniqlo's, etc.
I do, because I think still the awards allow the papers a reason and a peg to write about the designers in a way. Otherwise, it's a lot of online coverage with bloggers, but the papers suddenly have a reason to look seriously at the careers, what they're doing, compare them, and the business behind the brands.
And what about London, Gillian? I mean, you know, your view, because as you said, I mean, you've been doing this for a long time. I mean, you know, certainly in a video context as well. You know, and you always sort of hear that London, you know, wants to come back. Is it back? I mean, what is your view?
I think it is back, partly because I think it has a strong retail scene as well, and I think the opportunities for retail and buying here is very strong. So I think it is good. And then you still always get that sense of discovery. People are always coming to see the graduates of Central St. Martin's, the graduates of RCA, people who don't even go to the fashion colleges that are coming. And I think that is always going to be a draw in London, that undiscovered talent, spotting it first.
It's interesting if you saw the cover of the Financial Times this morning. I mean, two things from a positioning point of view from the paper, to be running this big Dominique Strauss-Kahn investigation. So you think, well, on one side, maybe it's a little bit late to be doing that story, but I get, you know, this is also just the hallmark of good journalism, because it says, you know, just the byline is by FT reporters. You know, it says most detailed account, high fives on ex-IMF chief's arrest, you know, mystery over missing phone. So it's an interesting kind of story, because it, you know, it's not a breaking news piece that you would normally have above the fold on a newspaper. It's very much almost like a Vanity Fair style story.
So what do you think you're doing? What's the message there?
I think it's an interesting way of also selling a weekend paper. I think, you know, that's almost the bigger message than actually what the story is, which I think is kind of fascinating. The other thing too, which is I'm really keen tomorrow to talk to our colleague Sophie Grove, who just came back from Iceland, and we've been talking about this big Chinese deal. That Huang Nubo was going to buy this massive tract of land. And of course, everyone knew that Iceland, of course, needs the money. But the interior minister's blocked it. It's not going to happen, which is quite interesting. Anything else grab your attention? What else do you think today?
No, I'm saving everything up for the magazine review, Tyler.
or saving everything up, you know, after we're off air. Just something else, in which I think is kind of interesting as well, a piece in out of the magazine, which is in the Herald Tribune today, but it talks about marketing to a gluten-free world and just the whole vogue of more people, you know, being identified as gluten intolerant. I haven't sort of seen how cynical the article is yet as to whether or not this is simply just a marketing ploy or not. In review fashion, been a good week for you? Because I think we had an interesting event on Thursday evening.
Yes, we did. We were at the Victoria and Albert Museum and we were doing a debate about soft power and museums in the context of soft power and how museums can be sort of brand extensions or brand ambassadors. So we're hoping to cut a little film of that, which we're going to put up on our website just to, with the highlights of the thinkers there. But now you're listening here to The Review on Monocle 24. In a moment, we're going to be hearing from our booksellers about the titles doing particularly well in their part of the world after this short break.
And it is now indeed time to see what the bookshops are saying around the world.
This week, we sent our correspondents to their locals in Hamburg, Toronto, and a little closer to home here in London. We start with a tour in Hamburg.
My name is John Cohen. My bookshop is called Cohen and Dobernik. We are here in a part of Hamburg that is a big gentrification area. It's in a big change. We mainly sell fiction here, half fiction, and the other half we sell design books and books about architecture and music and arts. We have young and urban customers, and that's the books we also sell. We look for small publishers as well, so we don't have everything here that you find in the big shops, because lots of these books we just find boring, and our customers are pleased not to see them. But therefore, we have quite a lot of books here you won't find in the big chains. The first book I would think is very interesting, and also we've sold quite a few copies already, is a really big, massive, I think 5 kilo book about the Magnum Photography Agency. There have been thousands of books about this agency, but this time they show the famous photos and show the contact sheets which have been found them. So you can see which of the shots the photographers didn't publish and which ones they were them. And that's very interesting to look at, because you can think yourself, why did he use this shot and not the other one? And that's a very nice, very interesting special photography book. The second book is a very local author here, Tino Hanekamp. The German title is Sowas von da. I don't know how to translate it really, but it's about the last night in his own music club. Tino Hanekamp really was the owner of a famous music club in Hamburg, and the book is about the last party on 31st of December, where they had sort of a breakdown party in this club, and it's really funny as well, and party, but underneath the party there are some deep themes as well. So that's a really good seller here, and I hope it's going to be translated into English sometime. Third book is a little photography book about the area our bookshop is in as well. We are here in a part of Hamburg that is in a big change. This book is about how it looked here in the 80s. So it's a book, of course, we sell a lot here, and a lot of people come and say, oh, that's what it looked like. And it's nice and interesting to see. And of course, we talk about books here, and I think there are something like 60,000 German books coming every year. And we are looking forward to the next 60,000 of next year. At the moment, I really don't look at the catalogs there for the next coming books, but generally we are always very interested in what's coming, and it's the best part about this job, really, is always to look at the new catalogs and finding out the books which we find interesting, and hopefully, and mostly it's that, like that, our customers like them as well.
That was John Cohen from the bookshop Cohen and Dornenberg in Hamburg. And Tyler, I'm really pleased to see that photography is doing so well in Hamburg, and also that the book we spoke about the other day, the Magnum Contacts book, is doing so well.
Absolutely. And Hamburg is such an incredible, it's an incredible media market as a city, because you've got the likes of Stern and Der Spiegel and of course, a number of major broadcasters based there. So one thing you do notice when you go into bookshops in Hamburg, you know, and as you identified, great to see that photography is doing well there. But, you know, I would say if I had to, you know, go and spend a weekend and just wanted to stock up on great reference for architecture and for graphic design, you know, as much as sort of photography, you know, not just Cohen and Dobernik, but there's a number of really, really amazing bookstores. And again, the only challenge with Germany, though, is that you always sort of wish, you know, that these stores are also open on a Sunday as well, because I think, you know, there is a wonderful sort of coziness to that city. We should probably jump over to a city which was a former hometown for both of us. This is, we're going over to Toronto.
My name is Sheila Kaufman. The store is Another Story Bookshop. We're on Roncesvalles in Toronto, Canada. We've been around for 24 years, which I think is really great given that we're an independent bookstore. We tend to specialize in equity and diversity and social justice, but we're also a community bookstore, so we do a lot of local authors, etc. We have children's books and adult books. We found out a long time ago that we wouldn't succeed as just a community bookstore. So we do a lot of tables outside the store, and we've been doing tables for teacher librarians. So I can give you an idea of some of the kids' books that have been really great this past week. One is called My Princess Boy, which is written about, it's written by a mother of a little boy that likes to wear dresses, and it's a really great little book. And the other one is a book called These Hands, which is a book about a little boy and a grandfather. The grandfather talks about segregation and what his hands meant before segregation and how they were used to sort of write petitions and carry signs, and it's a really great book. The books that are really, really hot in terms of fiction are Half-Blood Blues, which just won the Giller Prize in Canada, and Sisters Brothers, which they're both Canadian books, and Sisters Brothers was also a nominee for the Giller, and both books were nominated for the Booker. We've also been selling a lot of Canadian political books.
That was Sheila Kaufman from another story bookshop in Toronto.
It's funny that it's on Roncesvalles in Toronto, because that is I had my mom lives in West Toronto around Old Mill, but I was there a couple of weeks ago, and it was actually just going up that one stretch of the street. It's always been sort of the odd. It was always interesting from an ethnic point of view, you know, kind of interesting Polish and Eastern European delis, etc., which was great for that. But it is kind of picking up, and I was just like looking at some shop signs, and I snapped a couple of pictures of some real estate agents' numbers, because that area actually has a certain nice coziness to it.
Well, it's interesting. I lived on Queen West, not too far away, but we never traveled that far west. But now right. There's Ossington. I mean, it used to be known for a lot of the homeless people there,
yeah.
The psychiatric patients were there. But that's why it is a great part of the town for opportunity.
And there's also great scale there, I think, because you see the size of the shop. So I think it's of course that part the rent wouldn't be that high anyway. But the footprints of the stores are quite small, and it's good to see that that Toronto has some smaller retailers, certainly on the book side, that are combating against those dreadful box bookstores that are everywhere else.
And Canadians are quite good at doing little cafes, so it's the mix of bookstores and cafes.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be quite nice.
I'm not sure if I still want to live there, but anyway, should we? Where are we going next?
We're going across the park behind our office. We're tumbling into our local,
which is if you actually had to measure it, if you could walk. And go sort of through the wall. It's only
60
meters. Yeah, 100 meters maybe away from us, which is great.
But the park. But so we sent our correspondent to talk to Adam Clark at Daunt Books in Marylebone.
My name is Adam Clark. I work at Daunt Books in Marylebone High Street in London. We are an independent bookshop. We've been trading for 20 years, specializing in travel and international literature. Our windows are absolutely packed with all kinds of new books on every subject, for not fiction, non-fiction, poetry, art, design, lots of children's books. There's lots of wonderful kids' books. We've got a wonderful pop-up book on London. There's a new novel for children by David Walliams called Gangster Granny. So many fun things. My particular recommendation at the moment is the new novel from P.D. James, one of Britain's best-known, best-loved crime novelists. She's written a crime novel based around the characters from Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. It's called Death Comes to Pemberley. It's really, really good fun. Obviously, at this time of year, for Christmas, there are a lot of new books being published. At the moment, we're selling an awful lot of copies of Michael Lewis's new book, Boomerang, on the financial crisis in Europe. Also, we're being asked for the new book by Max Hastings, All Hell Let Loose, which is his history of the Second World War. In terms of fiction, we're selling a lot of copies of Julian Barnes' novel, The Sense of an Ending, which won the Booker Prize earlier in the year. And also a lot of copies of Carol Ann Duffy's poetry, her new selection called The Bees.
And that was Adam Clark from Daunt Books, just across the park here in London.
And I always think if I could have a Saturday job, I'd love to do their windows, because I think they do such brilliant displays in their bookshop window. And it's a great challenge between very, very simple, but they do wonderful themes. So I think it shows how bookshops can really do windows well.
And it's interesting. It's that one thing that, you know, no matter how much you might want to buy books online as well, there's just not that sense of curation, because, you know, you go to a homepage, and I think there's something about, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe at Daunt, you know, one of the major publishers, of course, wants to pay for a promotion or something. That might happen. You never feel that. But no matter what, I think when you look at something within a digital interface, you just feel, okay, I'm just being sold to. There's no way that, you know, what's on the homepage of you know, one of the major book retailers online, that it's sort of just there in a curatorial sense.
And when you walk by that shop, you literally do see people, they walk by, then they stop, and then they really spend a long time in front of the window, yeah, scanning the books and looking, and then they go in. It's a great example of good window display.
Well, I think sometime maybe between this show and something else this afternoon, I'm going to go and pay a visit to Mr. Clark. And one thing, you know, we're in the run-up to Christmas already. I went over the other day, and I'm just already starting to sort of amass my pile for the holidays. And what I did last year, which was great, is I just had it all boxed up, sent to Switzerland, and then it's just there when I arrive. And and that's just 2 weeks of sofa and maybe a bit of snow.
Perfect.
Excellent. You're listening to The Review. We're in London, and we're back in a moment.
J. Crew is thrilled to be shipping across the pond to our customers in the UK. Shop our famous collection of colourful cashmere and wardrobe staples for men, women and children. At J.Crew you can always expect impeccable quality, design integrity and flawless customer service every time you shop. Visit jcrew.com for the full story.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, but it's not just a show about tables and chairs. It's a show that takes in everything from the paperclips on your desk to the Prada store just down the road to the public toilets in the park opposite.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
It's a show that tries to tell the stories behind the things that we live with and the stories behind how we live with them as well.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
And you are back with the Monocle Review here at Studio One, or in Studio One, at Midori House in London. On a somewhat, what is it? It feels a little bit pre-winter today.
Oh, lovely and crisp and
yeah,
sunny
it is.
And definitely wintry.
I know. So I was walking over here trying to clear my head. And I'm hoping that also our next guest we want to welcome, because this is where we move out of what we've done with the newspapers and to books. And it's now a little bit of time for music. DJ João Brasil is here. I have to start by asking you, João, is that really your name? I mean, of course, every DJ needs a handle, but you know, I can't think of course, a more Brazilian Portuguese name than João, and then of course Brazil. So, what's the truth?
Yeah, it's kind of half of truth,
right?
True, and the thing is, my mother has Brazil in her surname,
okay,
but I don't have in my surname,
okay.
So it's a kind of to put my mother's name in my name, and it's much better than my real name. It's João. My name is actually João.
That bit I believe. I'm not going to ask to see your passport, but I just thought, yeah, but it was the Brazil bit anyway.
Yeah, but it's half true.
You've been in London for 2 years, DJing, and it's just, over the last week, we've been talking a lot about, issues of soft power. And, what we come back to, no matter what, when people talk about the emerging economies of the world, you come back to, to Brazil again and again. And what I thought was interesting at the Herald Tribune conference in Sao Paulo a couple of weeks ago, what you heard from a lot of Brazilians, they're just saying, well, we're not an emerging economy. We're an economy that has emerged. We're an emerged economy. And I think always, one of the wonderful things, about Brazil is that, it has a readily exportable lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it is, you know, just the culture of the beach, whether it is the culture of music, but even, you know, what's happened, you know, architecturally in Brazil, of course, you know, we, you know, we're huge fans of the work of Ise Weinfeld, and, you know, and many of his disciples as well. And you just, you don't feel the same thing. You don't feel that same emotion about, I don't anyway, when it comes to Russia or China or even India, mm-hmm. for that matter. So is there a huge uptake, you know, for you being a DJ in London and maybe exporting or importing a Brazilian sound?
Yes, I think I do the both bridges. Yeah, exporting and importing, because I play in Brazil a lot. So I do like this exchange and I mix everything and I show my music is basically like mashups. That I mash up a lot of music, and every time with a Brazilian kind of flavor and beat. So, and I do a lot of ghetto tech that they play in favelas and in the north part of Brazil. So like baile funk and techno brega.
With such a huge country and so many different nationalities, what is that mashup that exists within Brazil itself of kind of musical sort of origins?
Yeah, that's the thing. I think the music in Brazil is a big mashup already. Before even the root music, it's like African with European. Samba is like a mix of like everything already. So I think I'm part of that, and I think I push the things. The music a bit further.
And you know what's interesting as well as some of the other influences that you hear, you know, just because of the, you know, the power of the Levantine world. I mean, you know, the Syrians and the Lebanese that are also you know, in Brazil as well, and the strength of that community. And you can sometimes, you know, hear, you know, certain elements when you talk about that mashup that that some of those Middle East sounds, you know, also you know, find their way into the music too.
Yeah, a lot. In the north part of Brazil specifically, it's like, it's Arabian modes, you know? You can listen to the Arabian modes there, like forró, it's like really close to Arabic music, and it's really nice. It's bizarre and nice at the same time.
We've got a couple of things you're going to play for us today, and I'm wondering if you maybe want to start with the first song.
Yeah, the first song is Funky do iPhone. What's the iPhone funk?
Right.
And the thing is, funk, it's a music that is a ghetto kind tech music from Rio, mm-hmm. that is becoming every day bigger and bigger. And I put, and they do a lot with like kind of video game sounding, and this experimentation is beautiful. And I said, oh, I'm going to do something with a product and a sound that a lot of people know, that is the iPhone marimba tune. Like music, and so yeah, and the guest is Marina Gasolina, that she was from Bonde do Role, a band that was pretty much successful here in around. They played in major festivals, and I hope you enjoy it. It's like tropical and
let's have a listen.
Fun. Thank you.
And you were listening to Funk de iPhone. You can say it much better than me. But anyway, iPhone Funk. And you are also listening to the review here on Monocle 24. And we're joined by the London-based but Rio-born DJ João Brasil. Tell us a little bit more about that, because I think we didn't know that you only told us when we were listening to it that that was also a bit of a special preview we had.
Yes, I think this was probably the first time was played.
Brilliant.
on the radio, and it's gonna be released on the 5th of December, and the record label is Man Recordings from Germany, so just go to the website and
excellent
buy the track.
Cool, very.
If we wanted to discover new sort of Brazilian music and an interesting scene, is there one part of Brazil at the moment? Is Rio strong on this? Where do you really think the sort of musical talent is coming from in Brazil?
This is so difficult question, because it's all over. You have like,
really?
So it's like different countries inside the country with different music styles. So you have, I like the baile funk culture in Rio. You have the techno brega culture in the north part of Brazil, Pará. And you have Recife, you have a beautiful culture, Bahia as well, more like African, and you have everything.
It's when we were in Rio last year, just to also go into some of the record stores as well. And I'm trying to think of that one amazing place where there's a cafe, there's also a performance space in the back, and you just got all of these just wonderful, you know, gentlemen and just, you know, the collection of music. It's an independent store, an absolutely wonderful, huge space. Ringing any bells for you? I think it's somewhere between, I'm thinking, you know, it's heading sort of direction back from sort of Copacabana, but heading towards, I mean, if you're driving towards Ipanema.
I think you're talking about modern sound.
You're absolutely right. It is modern sound.
Yeah, but I think modern sound doesn't exist anymore. When did you go there?
That would have been like 18 months ago, maybe, like a year and a half ago.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. They said they're going to shut down and it's a pity, because I love that store so much. It's really cool. Yeah.
I mean, do you think that, you know, within Brazil, that there is, you know, still an appetite, or is Brazil as challenged as anywhere else when it comes to still being able to buy music physically? Because, you know, in the magazine, you know, it's interesting, you know, we talk a lot about what happens, you know, in media around the world. And certainly if you look at the newspaper scene in Brazil, you know, is not in bad shape like it is in many parts of the world. I mean, you see Folha de São Paulo. I mean, these are like actually newspaper brands that are growing. More people want to actually buy newspapers, to be seen to be reading newspapers. But what about, you know, if you are a small label, you know, in Brazil, do you think it's quite challenging?
It's really challenging. People doesn't have that mind of buy a lot of music online yet. You have to... I think it's starting now, you know, like with new labels trying to do things. But I think still, like, the artists are selling their own albums. The independent artists are selling their own albums. So, like, they press and they sell in concerts and everything without a label. They made their own label. I think it's more like that is going on.
Mm.
And for you in London, so why is London a good place to do what you do?
London is the best place in the world for me. I love this place so much.
You and lots of other Brazilians.
But music-wise, in terms of being...
It's like you have everything. You have every kind of music genre every day. And
for musicians in Brazil, do you think they have to break out internationally and get out of the country to survive as musicians? Or how?
No, I don't. I think it's so... No, you have like a lot of artists that live there and played only in Brazil, and they are doing really, really good. I don't think so. I think it was more my drive to, because I like to travel and to see different cultures and interact with them.
So what are you going to play for us next?
The next one is Baile Parangolé. Was one of my first mashups that I made, that people starts to realize that I was doing something that was nice. And then this one, I mash like everything, Caetano Veloso with Ratos de Porão, that is a trash band, with baile funk, with the Tropicália movement, and it's like a big mix and salad of everything you can hear in Brazil.
Okay, let's dig in.
Na época gravou.
That was a very, very nice. How old is that piece?
I think 2 years. 2 years and a half, maybe.
Great very good. Sound.
Yeah,
great
wonderful sound. We had to get out of it a little bit early. I think there was about another good minute and a half left. So what is it? What does a week look like for you in London? I mean, is it sort of a busy sort of Thursday, Friday, Saturday night out DJing, or have you moved into more of a production phase now?
Yeah, I'm like both, actually. I'm starting a party as well, called Tropicao, with Cibele, that is a singer, a Brazilian singer that lives here, and Marina, that sings the funk do iPhone. I'm producing a lot. I do even working like in my album that I want to release next year, and doing music for advertising, and a lot of stuff.
And where do you hang out to sort of experience, enjoy, and discover music?
When you talk about that you love London, I mean, what's inspirational for you here?
I love, of course, like Barbican and South Bank Center. I'm always there listening new music. And I love Café Otto, that is in Dalston. It's like one of my favorite places, jazz, more like experimental and things.
And who would go there? What kind of musician?
The last thing I saw was a Polish Jazz Experimental Festival.
Got it.
It's like, it's really nice. It's everything. It's good. You should go.
João Brizzle, thanks very much for joining us. We look forward to inviting you back.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. I love this.
We'd love to hear more of your sound as well. You're listening to The Review here from Midori House in London. We're back in a moment.
J. Crew is thrilled to be shipping across the pond to our customers in the UK. Shop our famous collection of colourful cashmere and wardrobe staples for men, women and children. At J.Crew, you can always expect impeccable quality, design integrity and flawless customer service every time you shop. Visit jcrew.com for the full story.
Cut.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, will make you feel like you've seen, heard, watched, attended, and danced to the finest and most exciting events in the world's cultural calendar.
They're like metal, glam, monster band.
They've literally just put some names of pop groups in a bag and shook it.
What is this fantastic place where all these bands still exist?
That's Culture with me, Robert Bound, available all week. Find us at monocle.com or iTunes, download our app and listen on your phone, or just stay tuned to Monocle 24. Thanks for tuning in.
And you are back with a review here on Monocle 24 with Tyler Brulé and Gillian DeBias. And now Garrett Yonkers from Fantastic Man is also here.
Hello, good morning.
How are you?
Afternoon.
Yeah. Well, it depends where you're listening. I think, you know.
That's true.
A lot of people on the East Coast as well of the US. And welcome to our little magazine review.
Yeah, nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, I wanted to ask you first, as you know, we're huge fans and of course, what you with Fantastic Man, but also The Gentlewoman and everyone. I mean, so far, there's a much bigger following for Penny Martin than there is. So you have to sort of, you know, catch up, Garrett, because everyone wants sort of, you know, more Penny Martin.
They want more Penny Martin?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you have to dazzle them. But I just wanted to start, you know, what do you think of, you know, the state of magazines right now? Because, you know, you and I talk about this a lot, and I'm just wondering, you know, for you and, you know, everyone sort of, you know, talks about sort of the depressing state of the market. You know, what's your view when you look around the world?
I don't think it's very depressing. I think there's a lot of people doing good things, and I mean, I don't believe at all in that whole doom scenario of print suffering because of the internet or something.
Mm.
I mean, it's interesting. One thing I wanted to talk about, but I couldn't get the magazine, is the Style.com magazine that I haven't seen yet.
Right.
It's up the road at our little magazine shop on Tilton
Street. Well, I was
going to
say, it's upstairs as well. We can show you afterwards.
Okay. Now
in what way? I mean, for people who don't know, maybe set it up. What fascinates you about that, about the concept?
Well, I don't know exactly the concept of the magazine. I hope it's going to be somewhat original, but I'm not sure. But it's just interesting that one of the biggest online publications, Style.com, you know, who always went against the grain of being print first and going online then. I mean, they were purely online and they started a magazine, which is so contra.
Well, they obviously felt the need that people do still like to read things.
I hope so.
No matter how dazzling the moving images, and you can see a fashion show on style.com, but people still do like to
I mean, I hope that's the reason. I mean, I guess also ultimately advertisers prefer print ads over online ads. I'm not sure, but I'm sure there
I think
is
that's a lot of it. Too,
or right. Maybe we can talk about it in a cynical way that's still where the cash is.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
I know, because I think what's interesting is you know we certainly see that when people want to do things, you know, even with their own magazine, you have to be very strict with a lot of advertisers and say, magazine is magazine. If you want to do something online, you can't just look at this as being, you know, added value. And I'm wondering if that's what Condé Nast had to do, is they had to go the other direction and say, well, okay, we're actually going to give you the magazine almost as added value just to drive up the revenues.
Hmm. Yeah, because I think the whole idea of banners is kind of dead, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, I think so. I hope so.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
What is your strategy being there with Fantastic Man? I mean, because, you know, on one side, you know, have you just taken sort of a cynical view saying, look, let's just focus on print, that's sort of the heartland of what we do and maybe where our readers are, and not feeling that you have to sort of, you know, drive to actually sort of deliver something digitally? How do you sort of see it?
Well, we do.
I know you do.
Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, I'd also say that.
Oh, yeah, totally. I think our focus is completely on paper.
Mm.
Or not completely, but like 78%.
Yeah.
Where we do think it's important to be the best men's style magazine and remain the leader in that field.
Yeah.
But having said that, the fact that we're biannual also makes the year kind of empty sometimes. Not that we're not busy, because you can work for half a year on a biannual easily. Yet there are times in between that you want to say something. So that's why we started doing something daily on our website.
I was going to ask about, you know, the balance between the print and the website and the philosophy behind what you enhance on the website. Editorially.
Well, I think there's obviously a big difference between things you read online and things you read on paper. So we wouldn't do our 5,000 word profiles online. I can hardly read a magazine on my iPad, but let alone on a computer. So we do shorter things, and we do, you know, we really believe in the power of recommendations, and that somebody tells you, has a good tip. It's like, oh, if you're going there, you know, just make sure that you do this and this and that.
But you vet it though as well, or i.e., I mean, you still play the role of the editor. I mean, you don't just let people throw anything.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's not an open source.
No,
not at all.
Absolutely not.
No, absolutely not. No, I mean,
But it's amazing because, you know, we were talking to someone this week saying that, you know, isn't it curious, in a week when we saw this, you know, enormous backfire on the part of Qantas, you know, with, you know, off the back of strike, you know, their whole labor discussion falling apart, then they'd go and do this Twitter campaign, tell us about your most luxurious experience. You know, what should it be on Qantas? And, you know, everyone just says, well, it'd be great if the planes took off. That would be a luxurious experience. and also they were talking about, you know, the challenges for TripAdvisor as well, which is interesting. We had the digital media editor on from The Telegraph. And oftentimes I think what's interesting is that when you meet these sort of digital evangelists, you know, and no matter what, you know, open source, you know, the more people commenting, the better. And she said, you know, looking for TripAdvisor, they said, you know, they've got these sort of these star sort of, you know, users who are saying, if you don't give me an upgrade in my hotel, I'm going to give you a bad review on TripAdvisor.
Yeah.
So that's why we don't like open source.
No. I mean, just like open microphones are a very tricky.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Should we? I don't know, Gillian. Do you want to start, or I mean, Garrett's got some.
What do you have in your pile?
Oh, I like. Yeah, the top of your pile. I'm glad that you brought that in. No, not the FT.
This.
As much as we love the Financial Times, but that one.
I did think the DSK piece was fascinating.
Yeah, I haven't jumped. It was funny. Did you hear the top of the show when we were talking about it? Because don't you think it's? I mean, I don't know what your view is, but I said to me, it's just from a weekend newspaper point of view. Jillian and I were talking about it, saying it's really positioned as a magazine story because, you know, normally Saturday morning, I mean, you would want, you know, what was the breaking? You know, how did Wall Street close? What was the week? You know, like, and then yeah, you've got a big piece of proper investigative journalism.
Completely. No, it is a. But I also treat the FT as a magazine because I don't read it during the week. I can't be bothered to read all those economic ups and downs. And in the weekend, it's a magazine, I think.
Yeah.
So I don't perceive it as a newspaper. Mm. And so I do think it's a very apt cover story for them.
Yeah.
But you were talking about the Travel Almanac.
Yes, absolutely.
I didn't really know the magazine.
Where did you pick it up? And just, I mean, for people who don't know, maybe just describe what you're holding in your hands right now.
I'm holding this little A5 booklet. Called The Travel Almanac, with Will Oldham, also known as Bonnie Prince Billy, on the cover. And that's it. It's light blue, and it looks very traditionalist.
Mm.
I picked it up at Athenaeum Bookstore, or Athenaeum News Center, I should say, in Amsterdam, yesterday, before I flew here to London. Yeah, it's interesting.
It's German, isn't it, I think?
It's German.
Yeah.
And it is... I mean, in a way, it is the appartamento of travel.
Mm.
It's Q&As with people about traveling or where they're living or where they used to live, how they move, about moving, basically. I'm surprised you're not in it, but maybe you were in the first issue.
No, I wasn't. I picked up the... Is that issue number two?
This is number two.
Yeah. Because...
I don't think there's a third yet, or is there?
No.
This is quite recent.
It's. I think it just has a sort of, you know, a wonderful quality, and you want it. You want to hold on to it, and there's... Yeah, this is something which to me is just very collectible, and you know, is that what you found with the evolution of Fantastic Man as well? That, you know, probably if you went and surveyed people, that, you know, when it comes time for that big clear out of the coffee table or the bedside table, that there's probably a good chance that Fantastic Man is not finding its way into the bin.
Yeah, that's the idea, and I think that's the reality also. That's what people say.
But do you think a lot of publishers have also forgotten that as well? You know, at a time when, you know. I mean, I'm looking at a backlit screen in front of me right now, where this is just, you know, it's up, it's gone, etc. That maybe there's not enough value put into the notion of collectible today.
Oh, totally. But I think they accept that we're not going to keep all copies of Vanity Fair or so.
Mm.
Although I do,
right?
I must say, but then I never look at the pile again. So right. I'm not really sure why I collect them.
I mean, we've got vast warehouses out in West London. We've all of our old copies of The Blitz and The Face, but I'm you know, and there's always, you know, at the end of the year when we sort of look at our budgets, and you know, our very tough Belgian COO, she always says, you know, do we really need to be storing all of these magazines? Like, okay, look, we're not having this discussion again. They're going to stay out there, and I'm glad we do have them. And it is funny, you know, sometimes we do pull them out and you go through them and you look at old copies of, you know, The Face from, you know, God, you know, 20, 25 years ago, and it's wonderful. Because
it is, absolutely.
You just can't, you know, even as much as people say, oh, we're doing digital archiving, you know, it's fine to go back and look at, you know, a raw layout, but there's something, you know, bringing out a musty magazine is...
No, and I think magazines should be that way.
What do you, just, oh, go, I want, I want to, sorry, go ahead.
No, because I was shocked recently. I was in Italy and I picked up L'Uomo Vogue on the way back. I was at the airport and I thought, oh, you know, I don't always buy L'Uomo Vogue, but I bought it there. And halfway through the plane ride, I was like, I'm going to leave it in this plane. I can't be bothered to take it home, which I thought was shocking because I have, at the office, we have a whole pile of L'Uomo Vogues that are actually pretty good.
But of a certain era. You're just talking, it wasn't so much the brand, it was that just where the magazine is at the moment didn't appeal
exactly.
to you.
Exactly. It's like it wasn't even. I ripped out one page because I thought, oh, that's interesting. I like that picture, and the rest I couldn't be bothered to bring with me.
What didn't appeal to you? I mean, and this is not to sort of trash it, but I'm just
just like soulless and uninteresting and sort of
predictable,
very default. It was just the usual sort of a couple of actors, a couple of film directors. Mm. They're all one picture, one page. It's just this like portfolio of things that they started doing at some point 10 years ago or so.
Right.
But now it took over the complete magazine.
What do you, going back to Vanity Fair, what do you collect, if you could say this, if we went to your flat or to your office, I mean, you know, five things that you really like to hold on to?
There's Vanity Fair, there's the New Yorker that I do keep.
Hmm. Do you read it?
I do, yeah.
But it's when it is funny because those great New Yorker, and the reason I ask is, you know, I have that New Yorker guilt as well. I still haven't read I think I was talking about this 2 weeks ago, I still haven't read the bloody Gaddafi issue. And I've had, you know, five people saying, you know, you've got to read the Gaddafi story. So it is, you know, now it's my bag again for my flight to Washington on Monday. But the great thing is that, in fact, you know, it can ride around in the bottom of your bag or, you know, for 6 weeks and you can still go back or even 6 months. You know, I go up, you know, whether it's sort of summertime, Christmas time, you go to your house and there's all your old New Yorkers. And it's
totally. No, I have a pile of New Yorkers that I actually tagged certain articles because otherwise I don't know anymore. Did I read them? Did I not read them? So I have this pile and then every time I travel, I just take two or three with me and...
What did you make this? I mean, if you saw the cover of this week's New Yorker, sort of their
it's a very good issue, by the way.
Yeah, their Thanksgiving cover, and it's just great that you've got the pilgrims. You know, are either, you can't quite tell, are they running, you know, into America or are they escaping America? I think that sort of this wonderful sort of duality in terms of how you can read it. It's a good issue. This issue is a good one for what reason? What did you like in it?
I love that story on. I have to, she's called the Principessa Rita Boncompagni Lubovisi or something.
Right.
this Italian, or she's actually a Texan. She's an ex-congresswife, I think.
Yeah, Rita Jeanrette.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean,
I had never heard of her before. Am I?
No, it's funny. I used to work with her.
Oh.
Yeah, many, many years ago. And this is why I'm holding on, because she's quite an extraordinary, really extraordinary character.
And it's a really good piece on her.
Right.
Because it's such a strange story. It is actually, the title is The Renovation. So it's about the renovation of her palazzo or her husband's palazzo, or her husband's family palazzo in Rome.
Yeah.
They are the only private house with a Caravaggio on the ceiling, I think.
Unbelievable.
But it's such a weird story. It's not so much about the renovation only, as it's also her life, really crazy life story,
yeah.
I think, where, you know, from being a congresswife to ending up in Playboy and meeting this prince.
And then having an interesting sort of, you know, television career, you know, as well, you know, in between. I mean, really, really quite something.
And then there's this, all of a sudden, halfway in the story, there's this scholar popping up, who is also there in the house, and it turns out to be the ex-guitarist of the Lemonheads. I mean, it gets crazier and crazier. I like that of a good New Yorker story.
Yeah.
It's like, you think you've had it all, and then...
Do you feel that that's, you know, the direction that, you know, that the world is, you know, is moving in, that you may be, you know, America, there'll be sort of three or four or maybe just one brand like the New Yorker that's still going to be able to invest in the 20,000 word story and sustain journalists and do that, and maybe, you know, around the corner from Amsterdam, that, you know, Der Spiegel, you know, becomes almost like the singular home of still having, you know, 80 to 100 fact checkers, and still having, you know, the budgets to go and do good stories. I mean, there was a wonderful piece this week, which, you know, to me was only only Der Spiegel could go and do the story where they unraveled that Angela Merkel sold, you know, her version of Air Force One, so the German Air Force have been upgrading all of the government jets. And what was great about the story is that, you know, because of the sanctions against, you know, Iran, there are only certain, you know, aircraft that the Iranians can buy because they can't buy new planes, but they've got all these old Airbuses. And so it's interesting, Angela Merkel's old jet actually ended up being sold to Iran, which you know, this is all about, and you know, and again, that's a piece of journalism which, you know, really had to be, you know, unraveled, and it cost, you know, not just the time of the commitment of really sort of, you know, of actually having not just, you know, people sitting around and doing a bit of, you know, research in front of a screen, but it's actually sort of boots on the ground, you know, good old fashioned journalism. So I don't know what your view is. Do you think that, are we moving into a world where there's just going to be, you know, a couple of titles that are able to do that, and then we have the likes of, you know, the travel almanacs, things like that, which are sort of, you know, the, you know, more beautiful sort of vanity pieces, etc., that sit in the mix.
Yeah, I guess so. And I hope at least that there will be one publication in each field that will still invest in that.
Right.
Which disappointed me about Vanity Fair this month, where there wasn't really one story that I thought was like, oh, wow. You
know? Right.
But I haven't read the story on the Winklevoss brothers yet. So,
what is your, you know, your magazine, is yours a magazine, or your metabolism, is it a weekend read, or do you also sort of find that, you know, well, I guess maybe you don't have a lot of commuting time in Amsterdam anyway, because
no,
probably atop a bicycle. Yeah. So it'd be rather dangerous, I guess.
Yes. But no, it's totally a weekend read.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you prefer, you know, would you say that you prefer a magazine diet as opposed to a book diet, or is there room for both?
No, there's no room for books. I wish there was, but absolutely not, no.
That's I like that you've got the confidence to say that, because a lot of people say, oh, you know, I am reading this or I am reading that. And I was, you know, said that someone the other day. It's like I said, I'm just so absorbed in, yeah, just getting through my New Yorkers and everything else. And actually, that's what I enjoy at the weekend.
Yeah, no, the only time I read books is on holiday.
Right. Which is, you know, as I always keep asking you, when you're going to go away, and it never seems like it's happening that often.
Yeah.
So what is it, once a year?
No, twice a year.
Is I just want to go, because, you know, we had a segment earlier on where we talk about the bookstores that we like. You mentioned Athenaeum, which I wish there was an Athenaeum in London. Do you know it, Gillian? It's just this,
I don't.
You know, and it's interesting how they call themselves a news center, but it's open to the street. I mean, it's everything that you would. It's kind of on. It's a bit higgledy-piggledy, sort of multi-level, but you get all the newspapers there, and it's just, yeah, it's a great.
And also, they don't sell a lot. They sell, they're not selling a lot of mainstream magazines, right? Like the sort of like the gossip press, where they would make a lot of money out.
Right.
Yes. I mean, they just don't sell it. It's like, no, we don't have the weekly gossips.
What's the state of the Dutch media scene right now, would you say, print-wise?
God.
Do you see yourself as part of it as well?
No.
No.
No. No, because we're in English, and we produce so much here in the UK. I'm more or less the only one left in Amsterdam at the moment with my...
Well, that was my next question.
with my nearest colleagues. No, because everybody from our office is moving to London. So I'm sitting in this vast, vast office that is usually empty, you know, apart from my assistant and our office manager. And that's it.
Mm.
Well, I have some magazines here, a number similar to you, Tyler. But I always look forward every month when Creative Review comes into the office, partly a great source of story ideas. Mm. But just there are articles you won't see anywhere else. And this month, the one that just came out, is a wonderful article called Cut, Fold, Glue and Play. Mm. And it's all about paper toys and wonderful artists who are actually designing not in plastic and vinyl, but doing beautiful 3D toys, and specialist shops that are responding to this. And, you know, when you see all these 3D films in the cinema, it's wonderful that now actually there's a sort of an extension of that, which is 3D paper toys that are beautifully done by all sorts of artists. And there's another further on celebration of paper on the topic of books, where they're looking at book design, and they focus on the Dutch designer Irma Boom, and beautifully, beautifully designed books, and her saying that, you know, the point of books is not necessarily content, but also how they feel.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Look.
We just have about 15 seconds before we have to wrap up. For you, do you continue wanting to sort of push what you do paper-wise? You know, every issue. I mean, there's always a little trick and twist.
Mm.
And will we see more innovation come the next issue?
I think so. Well, you have to ask my colleague Jop van Bennekom, who is the master behind that usually.
Okay.
But we will
have him on another program, I guess.
You should. Yeah, he's here. So
excellent. Gerard Jonkers, thank you very much from Fantastic Man. Good to see you.
Yes, very nice. Thank you.
Happy weekend. That's all for this edition of The Review. We have to scamper scamper along here. For all of us here today on the program, I want to say a huge thank you to our producer, Marco Sippi, and also to Casal Condola, who is behind the sound desk. But for now, for all of us, I'm Tyler Brulé, and we've got Gillian Tobias here, and the news is coming up right now. Goodbye.